couch of potatoes across the country, around the world, on the radio and on the internet. I'm Kevin Carr, and you're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies. On today's show, I'm going to be talking about the new films, The Forever Purge, The Boss Baby, Family Business, Zola, The Tomorrow War, and Summer of Soul. I'm also going to be talking about some news, the Trailer Park and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Netflix's Fear Street, Part 1, 1994. But first, if you want to get in touch with me, you can email me at fatguys@fatguysatthemovies.com. You can leave me a voicemail at 740-205-6456. That's 740-205-6456. You can find me on the internet at fatguysatthemovies.com or facebook.com/fatguysatthemovies. And if you want to reach out to me on Twitter, I'm at twitter.com/KevinCarr.
Good evening. I'm Ron Burgundy, and this is what's happening in your world tonight.
The big piece of news in movies this week is the headline we've been seeing a lot lately is box office is back, baby! And it is, to a degree. We need to temper our expectations. I was saying this last week, because last week we had F9, the Fast Saga, have a, quote, record-breaking performance. And it did, but that record it's breaking is for the pandemic. And that's not to dismiss the fact that we're still fully in the pandemic with the Delta variant out there and everything. And this is far from over. But the reality is people are still not flocking back to the theaters in the levels that they were a year and a half ago. And that's to be expected because we have been conditioned over the last year or so to be a little bit leery of going into a closed room with a bunch of strangers for a couple hours. But still, F9 did quite well. It did about half of what its pre-pandemic numbers would be. I think if this had released in 2020 when it was supposed to, and were there not a global health cataclysm going on, it would have made probably about $150 million opening weekend, at least here in the States. And it's at about half that. It came in with about $70 million, which is great. I mean, that is fantastic for what we've been seeing. But we also have to realize that that shows there is still a hesitancy for people to go see the movie, not because of limited capacity, because I'm not hearing stories about how it was all sold out and people were being turned away because they could only half fill a theater, for example. I was talking to a friend in radio this week, and he went and saw it. I mean, he went midweek, probably during the day, but he and his friend who went to go see it were the only people in the theaters. But with F9 doing that well, and of course with A Quiet Place a couple weeks ago doing quite well in its opening weekend, those are your two big bona fide hits. Now, there are some other movies that have been released this summer that I would consider them doing well. Like Cruella, it's topping into the mid-70s at this point. And that's not bad considering it probably gets a $30 million bump from whatever the sales it did to the direct consumer through Disney Plus, which puts it as its initial box office is well over $100 million. And there's some other stuff that did well, you know, The Conjuring, The Devil Made Me Do It. It's actually doing okay. It's running, maybe 20-30% behind the other Conjuring movies, but that's to be expected with the day and date release that Warner Brothers had. Although I do think that right now Warner Brothers might be feeling a little bit nervous and a little bit of regret because, for example, In the Heights did not do as well as they had expected it to do. And so they're trying to figure out how to recoup these numbers. And the big problem that Warner Brothers has is it's committed to the day and date release through the end of the year because they sold it on that back in December. If you remember, right before Warner Brothers released Wonder Woman, they had a big push around Christmas of buying it all in advance. It was something like $70 and it got you the whole year for HBO Max, which was like 40% off. When they go back to the regular releases in 2022, and they've given every indication that they're going to do that, you might see a huge drop in subscriptions. Now, like I've been saying for a long time, we've got to see what happens when Black Widow comes out, because I think that's going to change things. If they can make a huge amount of money on the Disney Premium plus $30 per buy, that's going to be the new standard for Disney. And I wouldn't be surprised if Warner Brothers tries to tap into that. Or even like Peacock, which is releasing The Boss Baby on the Peacock Premium service, or Paramount Plus, they might start doing that. If they see that you can make money and direct money from this, they'll still do the theaters, but they're going to want to do something to your homes if that proves to be a very profitable thing. And I think it will. But the other thing to look at, and because it's not just about theaters being open, it's about how many people are going. And where you really have to look and drill down into the numbers is don't just look at how much it made. Don't just look at the gross. Look at the per theater average or the per screen average, especially if you can get per screen. You know, something like F9 was like almost $17,000 per screen. But if you drill down and you look at something like the Sparks Brothers, which is I think it's in its second weekend, it's making about $200 per screen, which is a little soft for a big documentary that's playing in over 500 theaters. And what that to me is showing is that except for the really rabid documentary fans in like New York and LA, a lot of people are going to opt for something like that online. And that's where I'm saying we're still going to have the theatrical model. We're still going to have the big movies, you know, Godzilla and Fast 9 and all those kind of things are going to be going to the big screen movies. But for the smaller ones, the stuff that does not require the large screen, big Dolby digital 3D experience, you might start seeing that stuff turning more and more often to on-demand options, which the theaters are already allowing anyways because they do that with independent stuff like Werewolves Within, which we talked about last week. You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the trailer park. The first one I want to talk about is Clifford the Big Red Dog, which is in theaters on September 17th.
Look at you, Uncle Casey. So cute.
And so red.
How big is he gonna get?
That depends, doesn't it?
On what?
On how much you love him.
I wish we were big and strong, and the world couldn't hurt us.
Bring a friend, join the crowd.
Shouldn't we try to hide him or something?
It's New York. No one will even notice.
He's a pig.
Well, you don't see that every day.
Maybe it's time to feed him.
I've been a fan of the Clifford books. I've read a whole bunch of them. I used to work in a library putting away books when I was like in high school. And a lot of times you sit there and you sort a cart and then you just read some of the books because they're, you know, quick and easy reads because they're kids' books or picture books. And I remember reading a whole bunch of those Clifford books then. And I remember liking them when I was a little kid. And then when I was a teenager, I was reading them, flipping them because I think they're cute. This looks like it's the closest you're going to get to it, but it does have that modern movie feel to it where they got to go, we have to make it relevant to today's society. Let's put him in New York, and then we can have burping jokes. You know, I must have missed the picture book where Emily Elizabeth is trying to not get Clifford to burp. You know, but that's in the trailer because you got to have farting and burping for kids to go see a movie now. There's always something that gets corrupted when they try to make it a big screen movie, so... The next one I want to talk about is Shang-Chi and the Legend of the Ten Rings, which opens in theaters on September 3rd.
Throughout my life, the Ten Rings gave our family power. If you want them to be yours one day, you have to show me you are strong enough to carry them.
You are a product of all who came before you. The legacy of your family. You are your mother, and whether you like it or not, you are also your father.
This is going to be a real test. Now, Black Widow's not as much of a test, and that comes out next week, but Black Widow's a familiar character, and she's been in all the Avengers movies. Shang-Chi is something brand new with Marvel, and when you watch this trailer, it doesn't feel like a Marvel movie. It feels like something that's more in line with Snake Eyes or Mulan or Mortal Kombat, where it doesn't feel like it's part of that Marvel franchise. And I'm hoping that the next trailer gives it a little bit more of that Marvel feel, because otherwise it just feels like kind of like a martial arts movie, which I think will limit its audience. But there's only 2 months until this movie comes out. September 3rd is just around the corner from a movie release standpoint. I mean, I think the movie looks decent. I mean, it looks entertaining, but... It really doesn't give me much to go on beyond it just looking like another martial arts movie. And hopefully it's more than that, because it needs to tie into the rest of Marvel. It's got to tie in with Loki and all the other movies coming up. So, you know, we'll see. I'm still hesitant on this one. That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about Zola and Summer of Soul. welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into the movie reviews and talk about Zola. Based on a series of tweets, a dancer from Detroit goes on a working trip to Florida with a new friend, only to find herself wrapped up in a weekend of human trafficking, violence, and other dangers.
Hey, last month I went dancing at this cute spot in Florida where my roommate's girl made like 5 G's a night. Because of my
We just met yesterday and you already trying to take trips together?
Be ready by 2.
Okay, wait, hold up.
Do not trip.
This is messy. You are messy. Your brain is broke.
I didn't do nothing wrong.
This actually came out Wednesday. It was a midweek release, so you may have already seen it. You've certainly had the chance. And I think it's doing that so it gets a jump on the weekend. Part of it's, you know, being the 4th of July weekend. But also there's a couple other big movies coming out this weekend. This is based on a 148-tweet thread by this girl, the character of Zola, who is from this movie. And it's a purportedly a true story. And look, I almost rarely will read the book of a movie. I at least did the due diligence and I found the 148 tweet string. I could not get through all of it. I skimmed a lot of it because it's a lot of nonsense and swearing and insults and complaining. But I read the gist of the Twitter thread. And it looks like at least this movie is marginally following that story. Now, I was also reading that there was some embellishing that probably went on in the Twitter thread. And it's also, you know, it's taking one person's point of view and she's a stripper. So I don't know how much you can trust what she says because she's a stripper and she's talking trash on the internet. So I'm questioning the full reality of the story, but you know, for lack of a better reason, they're following it from the Twitter thread. The story is about this waitress who she also dances occasionally and she meets this girl and they become quick friends. And then she's like, hey, let's go down to Florida. And they go down to Florida with her. Well, it's her pimp really, but it's her friend. And they do a little bit of dancing in the club, but then it's the whole thing is they're doing basically prostitution services in a hotel there. And this girl's thrown into it and she refuses to do it, but she also figures out, let's do this and charge more. And she was making more money through this than the pimp was. And what's weird about the movie is if you actually do the math in this, the math doesn't work out. Like the whole thing is for the services, he was charging like $150 and he only got like 4 or 5 guys to show up at the hotel room. And I'm like, well, that's what that is, $150 a piece. That's only $600. And you that's covering the hotel room and the gas to drive down from Detroit to Tampa in an Escalade. And you got your hotel. There's a lot of money that's way more than $600. So I have a feeling that in real life, they weren't in an Escalade driving down to Florida and staying in a high class hotel room. My guess is that they were driving in an El Camino to Florida and staying in a Motel 6 somewhere. You know, I don't think it was as snazzy and slick as it looks in the movie. I mean, it's interesting because it is crazy what goes on and it goes to these insane places. And part of it is you sat there and you do have to realize, where did they think this was going to go? Did they not do, you're just going to go find a club in Tampa that you can make 8 G's a night doing dancing? And I mean, come on. This does, the problem when you have it being told by one side of the story, you only get that side. And you're like, this woman's not as innocent as she pretends to be in her tweets, even though she doesn't pretend to be all that innocent. The movie's interesting, but I mean, it has some interesting twists and turns, but the characters are also sleazy. Even the good guys are so sleazy. I mean, just all so sleazy. You almost want a shower after watching it. You'd be like, gosh, do I need to wear protection to watch this movie? This is just, ugh. And it's just so gross on how everything's put together. And I don't have any sympathy for anyone because they're going into this with their eyes open and they know who they're going there with. And there's a scene in there when she realizes the guy's a pimp and not just the friend. And I'm like, what did you think? The guy picks you up in a black Escalade and he's tricked out in jewelry and bling. Oh, I just thought you were a friend who was driving her to Florida. No, that is not how this stuff works. And I'm not even involved in that business, and I can see that. It's one of those things that I think would be most interesting for people. If you love the Kardashians and you are into prank videos online, you'll probably love this movie. There's a part of me that wants to make my mom watch it, just for her to be like, why are you making me watch this movie? It's awful. And it'd be a great prank for her. But otherwise, it's going to take a very specific kind of person to enjoy this movie. But with that said, I mean, it works for what it is. So I think it accomplishes what it needs to do, but it certainly has a limited audience. But I'll be nice and say it kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised. In 1969, the Harlem Cultural Festival brought together some of the greatest names in music for a summer concert series in New York City.
Nobody ever heard of the Harlem Culture Festival. Nobody would believe it happened.
Six weekends of major artists.
The Panthers were the security and kids were sitting up on the trees.
I was nervous. I didn't expect a crowd like that. Something very important was happening. It wasn't just about the music.
This is available in theaters, but it's also on Hulu if you want to stream it to your homes. It's a documentary about the Harlem Cultural Festival, which there was another thing going on in the summer of 1969 that kind of eclipsed anything to do with music that summer, and that was the Woodstock Festival. Woodstock became so iconic and so well-known, kind of ticked every box you needed in terms of politics and society and music and culture and kids and adults. You know, it encapsulated all of that. So it sucked the air out of the room for any other story that summer, for sure, about music. And what happened with this Harlem Cultural Festival is they had people film it. I mean, they filmed a lot of it, but nobody wanted to do anything with it. Even when they were trying to market it as the Black Woodstock. And there really wasn't a huge market, certainly back in the early 70s when this would have had to come out, for such a narrow racial documentary. It sort of spent decades in this guy's garage, and so they put it together. Questlove from, what is he, from the Jimmy Kimmel Show? I think he's the band leader. He's directing. He put it together. And it's an interesting look at this music festival. And, you know, it's in Harlem, and it's packed. I mean, you look out there, just a sea of people. And the names that they have in the act, you know, like people like Stevie Wonder, Sly and the Family Stone, Gladys Knight and the Pips, Nina and Simone. I mean, they got all these huge names and they're playing at this festival. And I think it was just a cult. I think it was free. I think it was put together by the community. I mean, like the Black Panthers did the security for it. What's really funny is when you watch this, you see all these shots of the audience. And of course, it takes place over like 6 weeks, but they, you know, cram it all together in the documentary. And then every now and then you see like one white person and everyone was cool. It's like, hey, we're here to love music. I mean, it's a really inclusive thing, you know, because it didn't matter that there was this one white guy in the middle of Harlem during this thing because he probably lived there. The fact that people came because they loved the music. And if you love that music, especially the music of the time, this is a powerful and important documentary. If you like, especially like soul and you like that music from the 60s, into the 70s, during that time of cultural revolution, this is certainly something to watch. So I'm going to have to say that Summer of Soul, or When the Revolution Could Not Be Televised, kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for this segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Forever Purge and The Boss Baby Family Business. And welcome back to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's jump into some more movie reviews. And these are new ones that are out today. I'm not going to say they're both exclusively in theaters because the first one is also on Peacock. That movie is The Boss Baby Family Business. The Templeton brothers from The Boss Baby have grown up and are pulled back into being kids again to help stop an evil baby corporation.
Uncle Ted, I missed you so much.
That's my girl.
Woohoo!
You can't solve everything with money.
But you can, Tim.
You haven't changed at all. You're still a big baby.
Excuse me. I hate to interrupt. I mean, it's a riveting conversation.
She can talk.
A lot.
I'm in the family business. And now you work for me, boomers.
So, what's the crisis?
An evil genius is teaching kids to be very bad, bad babies.
No! Welcome to the baby revolution.
First of all, this is a sequel to The Boss Baby, which came out, I think, in 2017. So, it's been about 4 years. And what's interesting is it actually takes place when the kids have grown up. So they're, I'm assuming, in their late 20s or early 30s. So this technically takes place in the future. So this movie would take place in what? 2047. It's the same, roughly the same time frame as Blade Runner 2049. But they don't worry about the date. They just have them grow up and they're, you know, it's a sort of a contemporary story. This is available in theaters. So you can go to the theaters and check it out. Or you can stay at home and watch it on Peacock, which is Universal's streaming service. But in order to watch it on Peacock, you have to buy the subscription to the service. Now, Peacock, the way Peacock is structured, unlike Disney Plus, which you got to subscribe for it no matter what, Peacock is available for free. You can just sign up and watch some things on there, but they've got embedded advertising and limited selection. If you buy the, I think it's $4.99 for the premium model that has movies, it has either TV shows that are being aired online or like on Sci-Fi Channel, that's a Universal property. They all involve advertising embedded still in them. If you pay $10 a month, it's like premium plus, and I think it has very, very little or no advertising. I imagine no advertising because you're paying twice as much, and that's $10 a month. So that's reasonable. But if you want to get this just the ad-supported version, you can get it for $4.99, and then you can watch The Boss Baby at home. I mean, that's a great way. Look, if you're just one person going to go see this movie, just get Peacock for a month and watch The Boss Baby at home. You don't have to go to the theater, but gosh, if you got a family, $5 for the month, even if it's just a trial, you won't be able to walk into a theater with a family of four for $5. So this is Peacock testing out its own streaming premium service. And this is going to get more and more restrictive as it goes on. This is a loss leader for NBC, but they're going to start charging premium prices and they're going to start putting real stuff on there. And just get ready for that. They're going to do exactly what Disney and HBO is doing. But anyways, in The Boss Baby Family Business, it's another sequel and it's cute. It's very much got the same energy and feel as the first movie. I mean, I was telling somebody this week, I said, the concept is so stupid. And such a stretch that it seems ridiculous that there's this corporation that creates babies and sends them down to people on Earth. But they so committed to it in the first movie, they just went all in. And they didn't do anything halfway. They said, okay, we're doing this fully. There's a whole corporation here, and they've got this whole system and structure, and they got rules and everything. And that's kind of what I loved about that first Boss Baby. As, you know, not just the silly and goofy jokes, but the fact that it so commits to it reminds me of the Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs series, which is very different than the book, especially the Cloudy with a Chance of Meatballs part 2 was so out there and so bizarre, but they committed so much to it that it worked. And as absurd and ridiculous and over the top and nonsensical as it was, they worked to fit into the own little rubric that they set up. And they do that with The Boss Baby. And there's very funny moments, and they got some great voice cast. You still got Alec Baldwin back as The Boss Baby. And he's very funny because he's got that gruff voice and he's coming out a cute little baby. But you've also got some new characters because one of the guy's daughter is now a baby and she works for the Baby Co., which is what runs the baby system. And, you know, so you have all the jokes about, oh, here's the kid, but then they have to pretend to be a kid in front of the adults. I mean, it's a lot of the same stuff. And yeah, it stretches the story a little bit. It's a little forced, as most sequels tend to be. But it's still fun. I enjoyed it, maybe not as much as the first Boss Baby, but I really thought it was kind of cute. I liked it. I'm going to have to say The Boss Baby Family Business rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's talk about the Forever Purge. After the annual purge is reestablished, a group of people continue to purge after the 12 hours are up.
The purge is over, please!
No, it ain't.
This is insane. Nobody hear the sirens?
There's no crime anymore. Anything goes.
You rich can't hide behind your steel walls no more.
Powerless. How's that feel?
It's the real purge.
The Forever Purge!
Hurry up! They're coming!
This is what, the fifth Purge movie? They also had two seasons of a TV show. I think we've been purged out. Supposedly, this is going to be the last Purge movie. But if this one makes a lot of money, that's wrong. They'll do more. The last Purge movie, which was called The First Purge, which goes back to when The Purge starts, that was done by somebody else. And I remember talking about that a couple years ago. It was like 2018 or whatever when it came out. I liked the fact that it wasn't as reductive as the guy who sort of created the Purge stories, his take on a lot of that, because it's a neat idea, and I get why it plays so well. They make a lot of money because they don't cost a lot of money. Like a lot of these are like $10 million or less, and then they make, you know, even if they make like $50 million, you know, it's the Blumhouse model. And James DeMonaco is the guy who created the Purge series. He did the first movie, which was in essence a spinoff of a home invasion story. And then they got more and more political and more action oriented as they went on. This one, where they have the first one being a home invasion story, this is really more of a Western. It takes place in Texas, and it's about this family and their Mexican American farmhands who are helping them out on the farm, are on the run when these forever purgers start showing up. And it sets them on a run in a Western setting, because, of course, they're in Texas, so they're in the desert. And it really, you know, draws from certain elements of cinema. I mean, it's framed very similar to the ending of Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, where they're running away from the whole Bolivian army. And they're in the mountains, and there's the shootouts, and all that. Elements of a Western, and I really appreciated that, because I'm like, oh, they decided to go beyond just this Luddite, subtle as a heart attack allegory for modern politics. And I thought that was kind of cool. I appreciated that. And part of that's because it's not directed by James DeMonaco, which is good. Get some new blood into the series. But still, this is about as subtle as a heart attack. It's very obvious what they're trying to do. They're not veiling their politics very much at all. I mean, they're dealing with all the immigration issues that we've seen, border walls and illegal crossings and the refugee status and people fleeing a violent nature in a country. Only they flip the script on this one because they're fleeing America because of the forever purgers. And there's a problem when you have something that's not subtle like this. For the people that are aligned with the politics of the movie, it's kind of insulting, because you're like, gosh, this is so obvious. And if you're not aligned with the politics of the movie, it's also insulting, because it's such a blatant attack without being subtle. You know, like Star Wars actually has a certain level of subtlety. Yeah, it's about fascism, but there's a certain level of subtlety behind that. But not this one. You know, like when they had The Hunt, remember that movie that came out a little more than a year ago that was about these elites hunting deplorables, is how they put it. There was some real interesting subtleties and nuances in the script where on the surface it looked very basic, but if you dug down, it actually had a lot to say beyond just that very basic thing. This one doesn't. It's all just 100% basic rednecks killing Mexicans kind of thing. Let's put it this way. It's not smart, but it's a little smarter than the other Purge movies. And I appreciated the wink and the nod to a history of Western movies in American cinema. So I'm going to say, and I'm going to be nice. I've been nice lately, and I'm going to say that this kind of rocks.
It kind of rocks.
That's it for the segment. I need to go to a break. When I come back, I'm going to be talking about The Tomorrow War and the Home Cinema Roundup featuring Fear Street 1994. Welcome back to Feck Eyes at the Movies with Kevin Carr. Let's finish up the movie reviews and talk about The Tomorrow War on Amazon Prime right now. Humans come from the future to recruit fighters in a war 30 years from now or face extinction.
We are fighting a war 30 years in the future.
Is this a joke?
Our enemy is not human.
We need you to fight.
You got drafted.
I will be back.
In 11 months' time, all human beings in the future will be wiped from the face of the earth.
I was trying to save my daughter. If I gotta save the world to save her, then I'm gonna do it.
This was one of those big budget blockbusters that was supposed to come to theaters and then got pivoted during the pandemic, sold to Amazon. It stars Chris Pratt as this ex-military guy who now teaches high school science, and he's kind of caught up into this recruitment, or rather this draft from the future. And I'm very conflicted with this movie. On one hand, once you get past the explanation and setup, and you get to the action sequences, the boots on the ground, fighting the aliens, that stuff's not bad. I mean, it's a little bit derivative of movies like Starship Troopers and Edge of Tomorrow. Very much so, Edge of Tomorrow. But, I mean, it works for what it is. It also reminds me a bit of, like, Battle Los Angeles, if you remember that movie from, what, about 10 years ago, where it was this very monochromatic attack in a city where all, you know, the rubble's all gray and the creatures are all gray, the bad guys are all gray, and everybody's wearing shades of gray. Whereas, like, Starship Troopers was a little more vibrantly colored, and Edge of Tomorrow also had a better color palette. And that's, I'm going into the weeds with my discussion of what makes a movie worth watching, but it's sort of a bland look to the movie. My father, a couple years ago when I was taking care of him, we watched a couple of these movies. We watched some of Stranger Things and we watched A Quiet Place, and he was like, well, all these aliens all look the same now. The Demogorgons look like the aliens from A Quiet Place, and they look like the creatures in this movie, which look like the creatures from other films. So there is a certain uniqueness of design that is not there. These do look familiar. There's a certain familiarity to the design of the creatures, even though they are ultimately different. But when you get to the big budget scenes, the money shots, the action sequences, the explosions and the military fighting, that stuff's pretty cool. I mean, it works for what it is. For the spectacle, it's okay. It's not great and it's not groundbreaking, but it certainly serves as an action movie. The problem I had with this film is all the setup. Now, I grew up watching Doctor Who and reading comic books and science fiction. And so for me, time travel stories aren't hard to figure out, but Hollywood has always struggled with them because there's a lot of things you got to deal with. You got to deal with paradoxes and time loops and potentially alternate universes, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, if you've watched Doctor Who and Star Trek and all that kind of stuff, you know what you're doing with this. But the problem is now, in particular, because of movies like The Avengers, these movies have acclimatized people to the workings of time travel. In particular, everyone who went and saw Avengers Endgame at least understands about parallel universes and paradoxes and that sort of thing. And even if you watch The Terminator, they deal with paradoxes and time loops and that. This movie is just loaded with paradoxes that they never, ever bring up. They don't even address it at all. They just punt the question later on. And the problem is, it's not just the setup of the movie. It's not like the beginning. And I've referred to this before. There's a scene in that a second Austin Powers movie where Austin's trying to make the understand why he's going back in time, and Basil Exposition goes, "No, just don't worry about it. Just do it. It's your mission." And he looks at the audience. He looks at the camera and says, "We suggest that you also just ignore it. Just go with it. We know it's not good science fiction, but it's a funny movie coming up. So watch it." And they don't do that in the beginning. They do that throughout the movie. And I'm just like, it's frustrating because every time they have a new twist in the plot, it is just loaded with paradoxes and problems and questions and everything. And the thing is, it's so derivative of Starship Troopers and Edge of Tomorrow. But what makes those movies so harrowing when you see the action, you have this whole segment where they train people to fight the aliens, and then they drop them into the thick of it, and they just get destroyed by the aliens. And that's alarming because you're like, these people have all the equipment and the tech and the experience, and they're getting destroyed. Whereas in this movie, they don't even show people how to use a gun or dress them properly. They just drop them into a combat zone. Well, of course they're going to be destroyed. I mean, if you just took me and dropped me into a combat zone, I'd last about 20 seconds because I don't know anything. I don't even know the lingo of combat. So there's all that problems, and even as they get to the end, they keep having these things. Well, why do we do this? And I don't know. But it's got this time travel, but we're not going to use the time travel for ourselves, and we're not going to do this, and we're just going to assume people act this way. And it really is some of the sloppiest, worst sci-fi writing I've seen. But if you can get past it continually through the movie, the spectacle's okay. That's the best I can say about it. I'm going to say it kind of rocks because, like I said, there are some fun scenes in it, but it is infuriating to watch if you have any sort of background in science fiction.
It kind of rocks.
You're listening to Fat Guys at the Movies with Kevin Carr. That sound means it's time to roll into the home cinema roundup. This week is the launch of a new cinematic experiment from Netflix, Fear Street Part 1, 1994. In a small Ohio town, a group of teens try to stop a serial killer from beyond the grave.
We're all cursed. The witch is real.
She put a curse on Shadyside.
She's been possessing people, turning them into killers to take revenge on the town.
It happens to Shadyside over and over.
Bad things happen here.
You can't stop her.
Your best chance is to run from this place.
Fear Street is a series of books by R.L. Stine. Now, a lot of people know him as the guy who wrote the Goosebumps series. Goosebumps was for little kids. It was for elementary school kids. Nobody got killed in Goosebumps books. It was more, oh, it's a haunted house. Oh, look, there's a werewolf walking around. Fear Street real stuff happens. They're written for junior high and high school kids, so there are serial killers and monsters that and people ended up dying in the books. But they're a very popular series of books. I read a couple of them. And I respect the heck out of R.L. Stine for sort of building this brand. What they're doing here is they're taking three movies. This week is 1994, and it's a movie that takes place in 1994. The next one is next week is 1978. And the next one the week after that is 1666. And all three of these movies are connected. It's like a trilogy, only instead of doing one movie and hoping it does well, then making the other, they did all three of them and they're releasing them 1 week after each other, which is a brilliant idea. And I love the idea. And I was waiting to see this. And I said, oh gosh, I hope they do a good job. And doggone it, do they do a good job? Here's the thing. This is a legit, authentic slasher movie as it would have been made in the 90s. You know, something along the lines of Scream or I Know What You Did Last Summer or Urban Legend. This is more the kind of slasher movie that was made for teenagers who grew up with Friday the 13th and Halloween and Nightmare on Elm Street having already existed. And it's gory. I don't know if it's rated because it's not in theaters, but it's certainly an R-rated type of movie. And it's a lot of fun. It's got some neat little twists. It follows with exception of a few anachronistic moments and elements. It's very similar to what you would have seen in the 90s. It fits that mold. You know, the characters are a little bit cookie cutter, but that's okay. So are the characters of Scream. That's kind of the point. Scream was made at a time where movies were aware of where the slasher movies were coming from. And that's part of what changed the slasher in the 90s when they did Scream and subsequent films that follow that. And this thing nails it. It's a neat little story. It's got nice little suspense. It's got a lot of guessing. It's got an awareness of its horror roots where you see shots and you're like, oh, that shot's from The Shining. And then it plays ready to set up right into the next movie. So it primes a pump for next week when 1978 comes out. This is a great little idea, and I love that Netflix has done this because it's utilizing the streaming service as a delivery mechanism for this rather than just throwing it out in theaters and then checking on the next one next year. I think this is a great idea. I'm looking forward to 1978. I'm looking forward to 1666. I had a blast watching this. I thought this was a breath of fresh air in a somewhat crowded and clunky horror movie environment of today. So I'm going to have to say Fear Street Part 1, 1994, totally rocks.
It rocks.
Excellent!
Also available on DVD and Blu-ray this week include Willy Wonka in 4K, Battle Beyond the Stars in a Steelbook, and from TV, if you didn't get enough of The Purge, you've got The Purge Season 2. And that's it for this week. I gotta go. Happy 4th of July, and when we talk next week, I'll be talking about Black Widow. Until then, have a fat time at the movies or at home.